Good afternoon, Chuck Morse here at WMFO Medford, Boston. Welcome to the program. I'm live every Thursday, 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You're welcome to join me, 855-915-9636, as I get set up here. Again, the number is 855-915-9636. And I'm just being ham-handed, as people might know. I'm just setting up my YouTube so we could go live. There we go. No, that's not going to happen. Okay, anyway, welcome to the program. My first thought today, before I get into the hard issues and all that, is one that has more to do with my age. You know, as I get older, and as I become more aware of my own age, I start to feel little aches and pains that I never felt before and that sort of thing. And anybody that reaches my age, I'm not even going to tell you how old I am, knows what I'm talking about. And it makes you think about things like, you know, mortality, that, you know, I have less time, probably, at least statistically, and I probably do have less time on this earth now than I've already lived. And coming along with that is thinking about things that may prolong my life, may make me feel stronger. And, there's a huge cottage industry out there, always has been, of various remedies. A lot of it's snake oil, you know, that can help you live longer and help you feel better. But I want to just share a quick little thought about that. For people, for my listeners here at Tufts, to keep in mind, even as you're a young person, but as you get older, and that is that there are two things you can do that will not only prolong your life, I believe, but will make you feel stronger, make you healthier, spiritually happier, I guess, physically more endurance, give you a better immune system against various ailments. Two things you can do, and both of them are free, I may add, which is maybe why people don't want to talk about it too much. And those things seem simple, but here it is. Breathing and water. Breath and water. I find that if I remember and I take a moment each day or several times in the day simply to breathe a little bit wherever I am, through my nose, into my head, you know, through my nostrils, and I even like to, like, block one and breathe in and then blow it out the other and do the opposite. You end up cooling down the entire body. You oxygenate your blood. You revitalize your whole system. And there's nothing to it. I'm not suggesting any techniques or anything else. I'm simply pointing out that this has a... It has the effect of strengthening you. And I think that, if you're fortunate enough to live a long life on this great earth of ours, and you reach the end of your life, which we all do, then you will know that you had lived a long life because you had remembered to breathe. And if you don't live a long life, you'll regret the fact that you forgot to breathe. And this may seem simple, and of course we all have to breathe automatically, but I'm talking about a conscious effort to do a little extra breathing, a little deeper breathing, a moment to sort of take off, and maybe as part of that breathing exercise, you get to take stock a bit spiritually, mentally, emotionally of where you are. And it's just something that we forget and that I think we should do. And then the other thing, of course, is water. I recommend a good glass of good quality spring water when you first wake up in the morning because, to sort of get all of your cells moving, get everything in your system happening, get everything properly, hydrated. And then, of course, throughout the course of the day, make sure that you have a little bit more water. You know, when you drink things like coffee and soda, which I definitely don't recommend. I don't think it's good for you. I generally avoid soda once in a while, but that's not really the same as pure water, which is something that's available. It's either free or it's not expensive. And, you know, these are little things that you can do in the course of a day to improve your health. And I just thought I'd share that before I get underway here with harder subjects. The first, of course, being that I'm still not finished talking about the article that's appeared on about this program in the Tufts Observer, the article Morse Code. It's still there, still available. And, there were things said in that article that were unkind toward me, personally hurtful toward me, frankly. And I'm not discussing it because of that. I am discussing it because I think that the nature of the rocks that were thrown at me in this article have social and political import. The reason that they were thrown at me, it's quite clear. And of course, if you want to disagree, you're welcome to call. Is simply because I am a conservative. And that when you are a conservative in this day and age, especially if you're outspoken, and obviously I am because I'm here speaking in the very heart of one of America's most liberal institutions, Tufts University, then you're going to end up having those rocks thrown at you. And I accept that, even though I don't like it, and even though it's hurtful to me, and it's damaging, and it's not something I seek, I understand that it just simply is going to come with the territory. And I want to discuss what I think is a grave misconception, and, you know, hopefully with the goal of taking a little bit of a deeper look at not the motivation behind this attack on me, but the assumptions that are taken on by particularly young students who would make this kind of attack and do so without vindictiveness, without meanness, not even necessarily wanting to hurt me, although they might, I don't think so, but just because it reflects what they're taught, their worldview, which I would argue and I would suggest is ignorant. Now, I don't mean ignorant in that people are stupid. I mean ignorant in that they are uninformed and that they have been brought up in an atmosphere that, by classic definition, you could describe as prejudiced or bigoted against people who do not genuflect to the left. There's a misconception about it. And I think that it's something that is reflected today on American college campuses. I believe that the liberals and the left has pretty much co-opted most college campuses in this country. Over the past several decades, you've seen a gradual weeding out and retirement of conservative thought, conservative thinkers, conservative professors. And I think the left has taken over the levers of influence on these campuses. And as such, it has promoted its point of view. This, you know, it's not a matter of debating that point of view, which is fine, because after all, aren't colleges supposed to be places of vigorous debate and inquiry and places where young people learn how to think on their own and get critical opinion from all sides? But, and I would say this if conservatives took over. The point is that it's become conformist, it's become uniformal, it's become, quite frankly, intellectually sloppy, which is what's motivated and what's behind these attacks against me. They are not well thought out. They are just simply based on, you know, kind of quick and easy thinking. They're not considering the ramifications of what these attacks might mean to me. They're not really looking at me as an individual. It's more, they're turning me into some kind of a stick figure. And as such, once I've been dehumanized, if you will, it's very easy to throw these kind of attacks and not think that you're doing it to somebody that's a human being, that's someone that you might even admire. Now, I've been recently told by a friend of mine who is a psychologist, actually, that the reason, and a man of the left, is that this article and these sorts of attacks are something that I secretly want because I want to be, quote, provocative. In other words, this person is, and I think this is a very current view by the left with regard to conservatives, especially a conservative like myself, who, you know, operates in a liberal world and who's basically liberal in many respects, but yet not. The only way to explain that, that someone has not conformed to the left, is to say that they are, there's something wrong with them. There's something emotionally wrong, mentally wrong. They want to look at my past and say, what made me like this, right? And what they're saying basically is that I don't really sincerely hold the opinions I hold. This is all done because I want to experience a fight and I want to have like a provoke people and aggravate people. That's why I'm doing this. And that because there's something wrong with me. There's something, you know, that might have happened to me in the past that made me like this. And of course, they would not say this about me if I was a liberal. Nobody would say, accuse me of being provocative, right? Putting aside the fact that liberalism is orthodox, and as such, I wouldn't be provocative. Let's put that aside. The fact is that nobody would think of me in those terms. Nobody would want to psychologize me, look at my past, if I was liberal, because if I was liberal, I'd be on the right side. It would be wonderful, you know? I mean, look at how liberals are treated. I mean, if I were liberal, I'd probably have a book deal by now. I probably would have gotten honorary degrees by now instead of this kind of demonization and these sort of ugly attacks in a college paper. Instead, they would have written a praising article about me. I would have been held up as a hero. That's how liberals are treated, right? They would have drawn I'm being a little rhetorical here, but I would have made a cover, magazine cover, with my face in a close-up. All cropped, you know, all you see, this is how liberals get treated. It's like an idol worship, in a way, because I think most liberals or liberalism in general does not believe in a supreme being. They don't believe in God. As such, they need to replace that with the worship of people as great heroes of progress who are moving society forward into this great sunlit world, right? That's why you see, for example, Hillary Clinton, after when she was running for U.S. Senate in New York State, the New York Times Sunday Magazine does, and this is typical. I'm not singling her out. I'm saying this is how liberals get treated who are prominent. You know, this gigantic statue of her looking like the Statue of Liberty, right, on the cover of the magazine, with one foot on Manhattan and the other foot in New York State, looking up bravely with like a sunbeam floating from her forehead. And the article is like, will Hillary save liberalism? You know, that kind of thing. You know, I mean, more locally, Michael Dukakis, Governor Michael Dukakis, the Boston Globe, you know, while he was governor for years, issue after issue, week after week, we'd have to hear about how brilliant Michael Dukakis is. The brilliant Michael Dukakis did this. The brilliant Michael Dukakis went to the toilet. The brilliant Michael Dukakis, whatever. And, of course, the problem with Michael Dukakis was that, for the Globe, and later on they regretted it, was that he began to believe his own press. He started really thinking he was brilliant. And it went to his head, you know, to the point where he believed he could be president of the United States, and it led to a disaster, because he really wasn't quite up to that. But he had built this such as build-up. I mean, this heroic figure, right? Why? Because he was, a tool of the left. He was doing the bidding of the liberal establishment. And as long as he did that, he would be hailed as this great, brilliant guy. Every utterance would be brave. And we hear the courageous, you know, he wants to raise taxes. He gets an award from the Kennedy School. You know, I mean, this kind of hero worship and this promotion of the liberal, then no one accuses him of being provocative. No one throws bricks at him, right? It's all this great and glorious march forward. That's what would have happened, if I were liberal. Or maybe they would have written what I would have preferred and what I seek and what I hope to do in my modest and humble endeavor here at Tufts University and my quiet, relatively quiet forays into public discourse and advocacy, is to have a reasoned conversation about important and if not critical issues that face our society, that face our country, that face our lives, where we can differ and we can disagree, but we can debate our issues openly on the merits and let our listeners, let our friends, let our followers, let our, you know, people we come into contact with, let them make up their own minds. Let them weigh and measure all sides and let them develop their own independent thought. Let them take into consideration all sides of an issue. In high school, they do this thing called rhetoric where they have debate clubs. I've been involved a little bit in this. And that's what that does. And it's quite good. I mean, it's a way to have, you know, opposite opinions debated, not to arrive at any particular consensus. That's not the goal. But simply to make sure that both sides or multiple sides are presented in a reasonable atmosphere by which debate can take place. You know, positions, there is conflict, but yet positions are presented in a way that ultimately a person can listening can make the contrast. But that's not what's happened here with me, and I didn't expect it to happen. It's sad to me that it isn't happening because that's what I want to have. But what's happened is something that's predictable. It is drearily predictable. And that is that instead of these two aforementions, I have to be destroyed. I have to be denounced. I have to be investigated because the left does not want to have a reasonable debate with me or any conservative. And I'm not touting my own horn here. I'm saying just the issue itself, because they're maybe afraid they might lose such a debate, and they can't lose because they're all about winning. They're all about power. They're all about control. You know, they don't, you know, again, I mean, philosophically, I'm not talking about individuals here, but philosophically, leftism doesn't have any place for God or supernatural or spiritual. They want to have physical, material transformation in society, and as such, they cannot tolerate anything that might bring up powers that might exist outside of their own fecund imaginations. So they have to destroy that. That's why they threw these rocks at me in this article in Tufts Observer. It's an article, you can read it. It's called Morse Code. Anyway, I have written couple of responses to the article, and the one that I wrote last night is the one that I'm going to refer to right now. I have submitted this to Newsmax for publication. They usually publish articles by me on a weekly basis. For some reasons maybe that's not so hard to understand, they've been reluctant to talk about this issue and publish my articles. We'll see later today whether they publish this particular article, but I'm going to read it, but before I do, let me again give out the number if you want to join the conversation. I am live here at Tufts University, WMFO Medford. The number is 855-915-9636. 855-915-9636. Maybe before we do this, I'm going to take a brief break and do a public service announcement. In the meantime, you're welcome aboard.
Son and I failed to shoot off a rocket.
He knew exactly what to do.
I had no clue what I was doing.
We set up the rocket. Hit ignition.
And then nothing. Sometimes I laugh when I'm frustrated.
Then out of nowhere, the rocket launched into the air.
The rocket did get into the air.
I've never seen anything fly so high.
And then crashed into a kite.
Look out!
And then the pond.
I'll never forget that day.
Even if I tried.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Thousands of kids in foster care will take you just as you are. For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
Thank you very much, and we're back. You're welcome to join me, Chuck Morse, every Thursday here at WMFO, 10 to 11 a.m. The program is repeated on my podcast system, which is available at Chuck Morse Speaks, iTunes, Stitcher, where else? Google Play, and TuneIn. All four carry the show. Again, the number is 855-915-9636. And I'm going to go to my response to the article at the Tufts Observer. Conservative on campus. That's right. I am a conservative radio talk show host who holds the fort once a week at WMFO Tufts, a radio station on one of America's most liberal colleges. Tufts is by no means as bad as UCal Berkeley, where violent black-clad progressive anarchists infiltrated student protests, causing $100,000 in damages and forcing the cancellation of a speech by conservative commentator Milo Yiannopoulos. Conservative pundit Ann Coulter, her scheduled speech has now been canceled by UCal Berkeley, the university that gave birth to the free speech movement back in the 1960s. As a conservative, I feel like the proverbial fiddler on the roof, playing my political fiddle on the roof of the campus with the knowledge that one brisk gust of wind might knock me off my precious perch at any moment, sending me to my figurative death. Indeed, rhetorical rocks have already been thrown at me, and I have been put on notice that I am under investigation. When the article Morse Code was published in the Tufts Observer, I felt like I was back in a second grade schoolyard being mugged by bullies. Apparently, my discussion about how leftist policies have damaged the African American community since the 1960s is enough to brand me a, quote, racist, unquote. I also critiqued various misogynist practices that I claim are embedded within Sharia law, such as honor killing, a claim which caused the Tufts Observer to call me, quote, Islamophobic, unquote. This is apparently an issue, by the way, that being Sharia, honor killings, and all that, that concerns conservatives more than it does most allegedly feminist liberals. My show was condemned by the Tufts Observer article for containing, quote, blindingly obvious, hateful, racist, and bigoted content, unquote. I hosted a radio show at Tufts back in 1997, and now, after 20 years, I am back. I feel like Rip Van Winkle, who woke up from a deep slumber after 20 years to discover a new post-American Revolution society. The Tufts students back then, while liberal, were more ruckus and ribald. They were more open-minded to opposing ideas. Today, the students seem more cowed and docile, more conformist and quieter. Perhaps this is due to the fear of being reported on for a, quote, incident of bias, unquote, or for an ill-defined incident of hate speech. And by the way, on these both of these points, I refer to the published code of hate speech that's on the Tufts University website, and the fact that there is this this apparatus of bias reporting that's also on the Tufts University website. I'll get into that in a minute. In this atmosphere, I don't blame students for not wanting to express themselves too openly or to even allow themselves to entertain opinions privately that might not be deemed as politically correct. After all, their parents might be spending 50 to 60 grand a year for them to enjoy the privilege of attending such an elite institution as Tufts. Under the circumstances, it would be understandable to foolhardy for a young student to risk their reputation and possibly jeopardize their future. My broadcast at WMFO, a radio station with a proud and a unique tradition of honoring a free-form format, has thus turned into a case study for whether our liberal-dominated institutions of higher learning are fulfilling the meaning of their creed as a place of dispassionate discourse on critical issues, or whether they have become soapboxes for left-wing propaganda. In 1915, the American Association of University Professors published, quote, a declaration of the principles of academic freedom and academic tenure. And I'm going to quote from that declaration. Let me just see. Quote, it is not the function of a faculty member in a democracy to indoctrinate his or her students with ready-made conclusions on controversial subjects. The faculty member is expected to train students to think for themselves and to provide them access to those materials which they need if they are to think intelligently, unquote. So, boy, have we come a far way from then. I mean, today we have great, prominent institutions like Tufts University, one of the most significant and most important centers of learning and intellect in America and thus in the world, having things like, speech codes and thought police and this sort of thing. You know, they don't trust their own students to operate in a chivalrous and appropriate manner with each other. You know, and if someone is unchivalrous and unkind to another student, they don't trust that student to be able to handle it on their own. I mean, you know, our students are young adults. If someone is so ignorant and rude as to make like a racist comment to someone, which I think is probably, frankly, quite rare. I mean, we just don't have that going on, you know, in this day and age. I mean, I'm not saying it never happens, but people know better. I mean, it's so against the grain of our culture for people to publicly make a racist statement in this day and age. But if it happens, then, you know, there's ways to deal with that depending on the severity of it. You know, there are ways to, you know, talk to the person directly, first of all, as a first line. Secondly, if that doesn't work, talk to other people about it and maybe have other people say, listen, don't do this. You know, this is not good behavior. You're misbehaving. You're not being respectful. And if you continue doing it, we're going to talk to the professor, or we're going to talk to, you know, somebody in the immediate, you know, the dorm room supervisor or something, you know, not turn them into the police. You know, this bias report, first of all, the way they define bias is very vague. It's not like, you know, it can be interpreted to mean a lot of things, like, I don't know, maybe someone who supported President Trump. You know, it's like the people are not children. You know, this whole approach is classic leftism. It's just, you know, it's thought control. And it ought to be rejected. I also have online here, from the Tufts website, again, the Declaration of Freedom of Expression at Tufts University. This is from the Office of the Trustees. Now, from my way of thinking and looking at this again as an outsider, this is a truly chilling document. It has very vague terms in it. You know, it's kind of written almost like you see, you know, United Nations resolutions are written like this. It's the totalitarian language that was described by French scholar Elaine Benescon, who talks about this as the language of authority. You know, when you use vague wiggle words that can be basically interpreted by the eye of the beholder to get at those who are not adhering to the establishment orthodox agenda and point of view. You know, so, you know, since people don't really at this stage in our history express outright racist opinions, and they don't harbor those opinions anymore. I'm not saying they don't exist, but you really have to pull up a few rocks to find someone who's into this, you know. But, you know, your average, you know, Tufts University student is not going to be into this. Certainly conservatives are not into this. And yet, you know, in a sense, it's an expression in terms of how successful we've become as a society, that the left has to now cast the net wider and try to put people under a microscope and find, you know, a racist gene somewhere that they can then magnify. And by the way, they're only going to do it to a conservative, believe me, and say, aha, you know, this person has something against, you know, black men and women, whatever, you know. And then the person can be publicly denounced in a manner that's similar to the Spanish Inquisition during the auto da fe, publicly condemned, you know, humiliated. This is what happened in the Salem witch trials, where people would have charges read against them in public. They would have their reputation destroyed. They could have their life destroyed. Of course, students are cowed now and are docile. Does anybody want to bring that kind of attention on themselves? You know, does anybody, you don't know what you might say. The place is like a landmine. And that includes even liberals. A liberal is just as, you know, susceptible to these sorts of charges as a conservative. I mean, if you step out of line of political correctness, you could be, and you could end up facing this kind of charge. And yeah, it's just, it's ugly. It's a situation where, yes, people are going to be cowed. They're going to be docile. They're not going to speak out, because you have to worry about this so-called declaration on freedom of expression. How about a declaration on intellectual discourse? And that includes political and social discourse, not just, you know, kind of trivial stuff. Isn't that what college is supposed to be all about? Aren't colleges, especially in an institution as Augustus Tufts, supposed to create an atmosphere and supposed to cause the result being a person who can think independently, can think cognitively, can make up their own mind if they want to be an ultra left wing, fine. The point is they get there by critical thinking. They get there by examining the issues on all sides and then coming to their own conclusions. And ultimately their conclusions are arrived at as individuals, not as part of some kind of a group collective think, which of course is why this is a problem, because the left is collective. They don't want to have individual thought. They want to have, this is why they've turned our institutions from, you know, organizations that help teach independent thinking to these sort of, you know, behaviorist enterprises where people can kind of regurgitate, you know, politically correct nostrums without really knowing what they mean. So when they call me names like racist and Islamophobic, which are just that, schoolyard bully names, these are just taunts. They don't even know what those terms mean. I mean, what are they really saying? That I have something against black men and women? Is that what they're saying? Really? All right. So, you know, I'm going to try to put this aside, even though I will admit I am still pretty wrapped up in it emotionally. I mean, it's not easy to see your name in print and to have this kind of ugly, hateful attack against you. If someone wants to challenge me on this, if the author, I've invited the author of the article to come on the show. She's declined. But certainly anyone involved in this terrible assault against me personally and my character, if anybody wants to come up here and talk about it, they are welcome anytime. I welcome that. I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think anybody's going to come up here and talk to me because of the very reasons I mentioned. They might run afoul of the anti-bias police or the hate speech commission, they'll be brought up on charges. I don't blame them. You know, I mean, I really don't. Anyway, again, Chuck Morse here at Tufts University, WMFO, live every Thursday, at least so far. God willing, will continue to be from 10 to 11 a.m. You're welcome to join the broadcast, 855-915-9636. Let's maybe shift gears a little bit. What else is on your mind this afternoon? I personally don't want to talk about this anymore. There's just a lot going on in the news that we could certainly talk about the Trump presidency. I think that the problems that Trump is facing now are the same issues that he faced as a candidate, and that is this kind of amorphous establishment. And it's not just liberals, it's not just Democrats who have this irrational hatred for Trump. They don't understand what the issues are, I would argue. They don't know what's underlying this knee-jerk hatred. But they are joined by people who do understand their opposition to Trump. And they're more dangerous. And that includes liberal Republicans, people like Paul Ryan and the whole and John McCain and all of these liberal, you know, rhinos, they call them, Republican in name only. People like Charlie Baker here in Massachusetts. And the you know, and they're joined by people around the world who are sort of these elitist globalists who are not interested in the things that Donald Trump is talking about. They want to stop those things. And their media outlets and their academic outlets, like maybe even Tufts University, I don't know. They're all against Trump. And I would ask students to think about why that is, you know, to take a look. Because I predict from the way things are going that, and I hope and I pray, frankly, that in the next maybe 2 years, you're going to see President Trump. And again, President Trump is just one person. He represents a movement. You're going to see this movement, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. You're going to see them peel off more and more young people, millennials. They're going to make inroads there. They're also going to make inroads in groups that should traditionally be pro-Trump, but have been so propagandized by this establishment that they back away. And those include minorities. Those include women. You know, they include all of the categories that the left has tried to isolate through identity politics. I think you're going to see the Trump movement make inroads there in all of those groups and reach beyond his base, which is blue-collar working people, essentially. You know, working men and women who, you know, want to succeed and want to participate and partake in the American dream of freedom and individual choice and opportunity. You're going to see that expand because what President Trump is doing right now, in spite of this liberal Congress headed up by liberal Republicans, is just that. He's moving things forward. He's moving things forward domestically, which is the most important. But he's also moving things forward on the world stage in that there's growing evidence that President Trump, to comment on the world situation briefly, has restored remarkably rapidly America's position in the world as the respected force. He's done it simply by discarding the language of totalitarianism that was made popular, and not just by Barack Obama, but by several administrations going way back, probably to Reagan, where the United States does not take a position based upon our national ethos and our moral sense, but rather involves this vague sort of, you know, double talk, where we don't know who we are, what we are, and there's a weakness that is projected as a result. I think in the case of Barack Obama, it was quite deliberate. President Trump speaks, and his people around him, his cabinet members, they speak in clear and unequivocal terms. And as such, we've just psychologically and morally, let alone materially, we've reasserted our force as a nation, I mean, who we are. And we've thus caused other nations and other people to do likewise in their own nations. You know, by America being stronger, we make Zimbabwe stronger. You know, we make Burma stronger. I mean, all sovereign nations can take heart in this, at least the peoples of those nations, because we have redefined or have again defined the progressive nature of sovereignty, the idea that the nation state represents the sovereign individual, and as such, the best course forward for a nation state is to retain the right to determine their own nature, their own future, their own interests. These are good ideas. These are progressive ideas. These are ideas that were articulated by candidate and now president Donald Trump when he talked about putting America first, making America great again. You know, these seem like slogans, but they're actually very profound philosophical statements. They're clear. They're concise. And I think it's proven that he means it. I'll give you some examples. When President Trump was still president-elect, he stated that he would sign an executive order that would require that every new regulation passed by a federal agency would have to be accompanied by the retirement of two existing regulations. Now, this is an issue that should not be political. It should not be left or right. It should not be Democrat or Republican. This is an issue of good government. We ought to assume that our government is always looking at the body of regulations, and for the same reason that we expect them to pass new laws that can improve governing in our way of life, we also expect them to get rid of bad laws or laws that are no longer relevant or laws that are redundant or laws that might be too expensive, that they're causing a deficit, or for a variety of reasons, laws that are not good. I mean, it's just good government to get rid of those laws. This is the first time in my memory that we have an executive, a president, who actually has signed an order saying that you have to get rid of these bad laws and thus streamline government. I mean, this is basic government 101. This is good government, right? It gets rid of stuff that's making our life more difficult, that's interfering with our freedoms, you know, that's over-regulation, and it's replacing it with new regulations that actually can be good and work and can be effective. And I just read the other day that now 14 states are emulating the federal government, and they're doing it on a statewide level. I mean, we should call Charlie Baker. You want to talk about too much regulation. Massachusetts, for its size, probably has more laws than any state in this union. And they just keep piling them on. And these laws affect us. They cost us money. They're ripoffs in many cases. You know, I mean, it just came to my attention the other day that, I heard a radio show where someone, to get a license to become a police officer, they have to pass a test in every single jurisdiction, and it costs a great deal of money, and there's all that. These are redundant laws. I mean, it could be streamlined so that one could take one test, and with one fee that could be reduced, hopefully, and they're in. You know, it's like, is it really necessary? So there's an example of making America great again. The other example I'll give is Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has now said that he is investigating whether or not Iran is observing this awful treaty that was put into law by President Obama, over the objection of Congress, by the way. He did it through the United Nations, and he gave them enormous amounts of money so that they would sign a treaty that allows them to continue, ultimately, their nuclear proliferation, which they've done. I mean, they're not supposed to, but, you know, it kind of, with the language of totalitarianism, the vagaries, it creates an atmosphere by which they can, and they have. And Rex Tillerson is saying that if, in fact, Iran is violating the treaty, which they are, then he's going to rescind the treaty, which is what Barack Obama didn't do. On the surface, Barack Obama might have just wanted to ignore the fact that Iran was violating the treaty. If he didn't think it was happening, then it wasn't happening. You just sort of, this isn't happening, you know? There's a massive increase in murders in Chicago. What do you do about it? You pretend it's not happening. You know, successive administrations going all the way back, frankly, to Reagan, both Republican and Democrat, have failed to enforce our border crossings, right? I mean, this is a national disgrace, but pretend it's not happening. Pretend it's okay that we have people just entering the country that we don't know who they are. We don't know what their intentions are. In fact, some people think this is good. I think in the case of illegal aliens, there's a combination of people who would be conventionally thought of as on the right, people who own big corporations who are looking for cheap labor and who are looking for off-the-books labor so they can make more money. And then on the left, you have people who think it's good because they believe in world government. They want to have the international ant colony. You know, they want to reduce America's identity as a culture and as an economy. They want to degrade us into becoming a province of the world. And they think the way to do that, plus the way to get votes, is to open the borders. I think Hillary Clinton, as a candidate, expressed this sentiment very well when she said that she dreams of the day when we would have open borders. Well, President Trump has expressed during the campaign, he brought it up. He was the only candidate to bring it up, that a sovereign nation, any sovereign nation, but in this case it's the United States, has a natural right to protect its borders and to regulate who enters the national home. It just makes common sense. It's in the same way that you as an individual have a right to decide who enters your private home. You know, this is just obvious. It's common sense. Any nation has a right to do this. This is a good thing because it's a humane thing, because it protects the hard work and the gains and the democracy, frankly, of the people of that nation. You know, you have worked, and your parents worked, your grandparents worked, going way back, to create a free and prosperous society, to contribute to that society through labor, through taxes, through effort. You have a right to expect that that society is going to be protected from just anybody who wants to come in and, enjoy it. Doesn't mean that we don't welcome people in. We should, and we do. But there are standards, like there would be in any nation. We want to make sure that people who come in are coming in for the right reasons, because they want to be Americans. They want to assimilate into our social contract, if you will. You know, I mean, that's how immigrant groups have done it. That's how my ancestors did it. They were immigrants. You know, they wanted to partake in the American social contract. And that meant a certain degree of assimilation and acceptance of an American ethos, an American constitutional system, not to import a foreign system to impose here. We want to make sure the people who come in want to do that. We don't assume that they do. These things make basic sense, and that's what Donald Trump has articulated. And in fact, he's already accomplished a great deal in that regard, whether or not he builds a wall, simply by evidence that illegal immigration has dropped by 70% since he's been president, and he's only been president for a couple of months. It's an extraordinary accomplishment. It's the first time that there's been such a reversal, I think, since the days of Reagan. Anyway, you're welcome to join me in the final segment. Chuck Morse here at WMFO, Tufts University, 955-915-9636. Come on down. Wrong number. 855-915-9636. What is on your mind this afternoon?
It's okay.
Let's go to... All right. Enough of that. I'm downloading the show on YouTube. By the way, I should mention that the program is available... not just on YouTube where you can see me do it, but it's also available at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and TuneIn. And we'll be there in perpetuity. So technology being what it is, there's a lot of things you can do. Anyway, what is on your mind this afternoon? Chuck Morse here at WMFO Tufts. The article I was talking about, not that I'm recommending you read it, but it's there, and it's nasty, and it's Tufts Observer. You can get a hard copy, or you can look it online. Let's see here. What else is happening in the news? Australia is planning to put in a test for citizenship. Now, I don't know if I'd want to go that far in the United States, but... we do have at least a loyalty oath when you become a citizen. It says here, and this is according to Reuters, Australia plans to raise the bar for handling citizenships by lengthening the waiting period, adding a new, quote, Australian values test, and raising the standard for English language as part of a shakeup of its immigration program. The move comes in a week when Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull announced axing a temporary work visa popular with foreigners and replacing it with a tougher program in a bid to put Australia first. Now, I believe that President Trump has already initiated something similar here by getting rid of the H-1 visa program as it applies to the federal branch and contracts by the federal, by the executive branch, which would mean that such contracts would favor American workers as opposed to foreign workers who are brought in at a cheaper rate. Again, this is a simple assertion of sovereignty. It's a protection of American citizens. It's a protecting, in this case, American labor. You know, it's a good thing. Okay, it says Australia has seen the rise of nationalist anti-immigration politics with far-right-wing parties such as the One Nation garnering strong public support, while the popularity of Trumbull's ruling center-right government has been languishing. The new citizenship requirements are expected to be passed by Parliament with the backing of, quote, right-wing senators. Now, is it right-wing to assert placing the citizens of a nation first? I don't know. I mean, I suppose it depends on how you define right-wing. I suppose it is in that, the Constitution at least implies that American citizenship would be... it's not a right, it's a privilege, as is the case in any nation. And that, it's not something that's simply handed out to anybody who wants it. There are certain standards that a person needs to meet, whereas the left, they don't want those standards. They just want to basically let as many people in as possible. At least that's the way it seems from their rhetoric. They hold that as a virtue. I suppose that it's... the whole idea of protecting the nation state, I guess, it certainly is conservative. I don't know if it's right wing. you know, in this country, race has nothing to do with it because we're the most multiracial society in history. And I might add that some of the left-wing racial identity people, they say that, for example, you know, Eurocentric. And by the way, I don't think America is Eurocentric. We're American-centric. You know, America is very different from Europe. We come from Europe, for sure. But we've developed our own civilization, our own ethos. I think we've had more influence on Europe than Europe has had on us. But putting that aside, their assertion that Eurocentricity is racist, and this is something that's been floating around out there, it's completely false. And I say this because evidence suggests, certainly in the United States, I'm not speaking for Europe here, but in America, that people of any and all races can embrace American values. In fact, I would argue that African Americans particularly are more American in terms of embracing, you know, Eurocentric values, Western values, than are, you know, white people. I mean, they have, the black church, for example, is more Christian than the white church. It's, in fact, been the moral juggernaut of a replenishment and a restoration of Christian understanding in this country. Black culture is more American, it's more Western than other cultures. I mean, you know, this idea that somehow because of someone's race, they can't embrace a body of values, and that those values are unique to any particular region of the world, and that they have anything to do with race, is ludicrous. You know, Western values, American values, Eurocentric, whatever, you know, these are values that can be embraced by anyone in the world if they choose to, and I'm not suggesting they do, but they're universal values, and every nation needs to find its way. You know, you've heard me criticize, for example, Sharia law. I don't object to, well, I do object, but I respect the right of an Islamic nation to have Sharia law. My problem is, and I'm speaking here, from an ideological standpoint, that I don't want someone else's ideology imposed on me. That's all. I mean, America is not oriented towards Sharia. We're oriented toward the Constitution. So I don't want to have a foreign body of beliefs or system imposed here, whether it be Sharia law, whether it be Nazism, whether it be communism or anything else. Monarchy. We got rid of King George III. So if they want to have a king, if they want to have Sharia compliance in their own country, that's fine. It's more to do with the idea of I don't want aggression, I don't want imperialism against me. I want to be an American who embraces the American ethos, which puts the individual first under God, as opposed to the state. And Sharia is very state-oriented, very much like communism in that way. So it's not, you know, it's a right of a foreign nation to have that system if they want that, if the people want it, even though I think I feel sad for, particularly for women, frankly. But I'm not going to interfere because it's not my right to. Anyway, we've reached the end of the program. Again, this is Chuck Morse here at WMFO. I'm waiting for Zachary to arrive. I don't see him here, so I'm not sure he's here. But if he's not here, then we shall go to the Rivendell system, if I can figure out how to do it, and I can. I'm just not the most adept at these things. Let me just see if I can get the thing up and running here. We need to go to the music part of it. Let's see. Continuous playback. I don't see it happening. Well, let me just see if I can get... Anyway, while I fumfer here, you're welcome to join me. Thank you.